From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We've seen the effects of climate change right here in Illinois repeatedly in the last 2.5 years alone. A polar vortex, devastating floods, microbursts that destroy buildings, record lake levels, extreme heat.
Governor Pritzker, with the stroke of your pen here today, this morning, if we're quiet enough, you might just hear a sigh of relief coming from Morris and Byron and some of these other areas where folks are counting on us to deliver. And that's what we're here to do today.
You know, we're doing everything we can to keep our capacity as high as possible. But no, it is not surprising at all that we found ourselves where we are because so many people are not taking this seriously.
Well, that is Aaron Herman, manager of Region 5's Hospital Coordinating Center, talking to WSIL-TV in Southern Illinois about how hospitals there are coping with having few, in fact, zero officially available ICU beds. Also, earlier we heard from the GOP Representative David Welter of Morris and Governor J.B. Pritzker, who signed into law that big energy package, putting Illinois on a green energy path to the future. We'll discuss that and more coming up here on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Hannah Meisel is NPR Illinois State House editor, and joining us today, Dan Petrella with the Chicago Tribune. Dan, it's always good to have you on. Thanks for being here.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, Hannah, last week on this show, that energy package had moved through one chamber, the House. Since then, the Senate approved it. The governor quickly signed it into law. So for those that haven't been following along as closely, just give us the overview of what's included in this.
It puts Illinois on a path to 100% clean energy in the next 3 or so decades, providing subsidies to 3 nuclear plants owned by, you know, nuclear giant Exelon, because the company had threatened to close them down. And, you know, the Senate finally passed the bill on Monday, which was the same day that, you know, the plant in Byron near Rockford was scheduled to shutter, you know, forever. And it's really down to the wire, which is, of course, how lawmakers kind of like to do it. They love a good deadline. But you know, other than those broad strokes, it will cost ratepayers more. Those in the northern part of Illinois who are in ComEd territory will pay toward that $700 million ratepayer subsidy over the next 5 years. Folks will also be paying a little bit more in their bills to kind of prop up the renewable industry so that solar and wind projects can get off the ground again. And, you know, put us on the path to having 40% renewable energy in the next 9 years by 2030. And, you know, it does other things like, for example, supposed to incentivize Illinoisans to buy 1 million electric vehicles in the next, you know, decade or so by providing an incentive. So it's broad, it's sweeping, it's huge. And finally, it's over.
So the governor, I believe, called this a giant leap forward. Dan, is it as big of a deal as what many of the people are that have supported it are touting it to be?
I think it will be a big deal if the state can actually achieve some of the goals that it has laid out. And I think that's the big question with anything like this. You know, if you think back a few years, I remember being in a gym in Clinton when Governor Rauner signed the Future Energy Jobs Act into law, and that was going to be the thing that was going to deliver all these great promises. And as we found out over the last few years, you know, the devil's really in the details, to use a horrible cliche, but you know, it's one thing to establish goals, and it's another to actually meet them. You know, obviously, as the many of the lawmakers who supported the legislation pointed out, the UN climate panel has pointed out that, you know, we are in a dire situation and something needs to be done. So you know, it's really going to be a matter of seeing how well the state does it, achieving the goals that it's laid out.
Yeah, Dan, one of the things about this that has come up has been, and Hannah touched on that, is the need to jumpstart the green energy industry in the state. It's been here. I mean, I think people can see, you know, wind turbines, solar panels in a lot of places, but how far behind really are we? We're not anywhere close to where we need to be to make something like this work. Is that right?
No. Yeah. The original, you know, the goal previously had been to get about 25% of our power from renewables by 2025. And we are not on track to meet that. There's a lot of reasons that we haven't gotten there. Part of it having to do with the way subsidies were structured under the previous law. You know, COVID delayed a lot of projects that were in the works. There was this issue where money that had been collected to subsidize renewables was going to start going back to utility customers because it hadn't been spent on projects that were on the grid by a deadline that was set in the law. So what this has done is tried to fix a lot of those problems to double the amount of money that the state is going to be spending on subsidizing renewables to about $500 million a year, if I remember correctly. So, you know, it really is an aggressive approach. And the question is going to be, you know, can those solar panels and wind turbines and other things get up and running quickly enough?
Yeah, Charlie, I'll just say for clarity's sake, I come from a family that has been involved in coal mining, a great-grandfather, people that did a lot of coal mining. It was a big part of the economy in the region where I grew up. At the same time, I wouldn't mind seeing a more greener energy future, but the jobs are a concern, and the jobs were a concern even in this legislation, Charlie, especially when it came to things more current situations like the nuclear plants, two of them that were set to shut down by the company Exelon Byron and the Dresden plant. The company now says it will keep those operating at least for a period of time. But jobs are really going to be the key to making this work, I think, in the future. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think the legislation also provides funds to try and create new jobs or retrain people who are involved in the coal-fired energy production to be able to take some of the jobs that are going to be created with the green energy, with installing solar panels, for example, or wind turbines. We were talking earlier about whether or not all this stuff is going to be achieved. I would say one thing that was achieved already, without which we would have no hope of reaching a green energy future, is the fact that Exelon will now keep open its nuclear generating facilities in Byron, which is kind of south of Rockford, in Dresden, and also going in the future, one in Braidwood. Without that nuclear fleet, there is no way that we would ever be able to get to green energy, probably for decades to come. And I think the coal mining industry has been declining, oh gosh, as long as I've been following this stuff, as long as I've been a reporter, that's more than 50 years. And part of it is the development of the natural gas through fracking and other technology, which produces carbon but is cleaner than coal. And the fact that the power generating companies are moving away from coal. There's been a decline in coal production over the years. It's been said that Illinois, in its coal deposits, has more energy than Saudi Arabia has in its oil deposits. And it's just a matter of moving away from using coal. So I think that one of the things we'll have to watch and see is to the extent that the municipally owned coal generating facilities are going to have to be phased out over time. What kind of jobs will be available for those folks who are going to have to find a new line of work?
Those are all things that had to be discussed. I would call the politics of all of this. And Hannah, behind the scenes, a lot of this was being bandied back and forth between the various different interest groups and lawmakers and even the governor's office. What did we learn, or can we say at least at this point, what we've learned from watching this happen?
I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. I mean, first of all, this is one of the largest, most, you know, complicated bills I've seen in 8 years. And certainly the, you know, not having former House Speaker Mike Madigan, who was, you know, very good at navigating these sorts of bills with a lot of constituencies, that was what he was good at. And of course, ironically, or maybe not so ironically, part of why the speaker is no longer speaker is because of his dealings with Commonwealth Edison. You know, last summer, the utility admitted a $200 million deferred prosecution agreement that it had, you know, spent years, or its lobbyists rather, had spent years, you know, trying to curry favor with the speaker in what feds, you know, call a bribery scheme. Lawmakers had to tread extra carefully because of that federal probe. And it was very messy to not have the usual process of years past where kind of utilities were driving the bus and sitting at their own conference table saying, like, this is what we need from Springfield, and leaders in Springfield saying, well, okay, you know, we can do this and this and this. So having a more democratic process, very messy. Of course, that is the way that politics is supposed to work. There's been a lot of criticism about how most of the bill was negotiated behind closed doors instead of out in the open in a committee process. But again, that is how politics works in Springfield for the people in Byron, whose jobs and, you know, kind of secondary, tertiary jobs that depend on that plant for the local economy. They were very worried, and it was to wait until the very last minute. Monday was the expected shutdown date for that plant, like I mentioned. A very difficult summer for all of those folks, but I guess we learned that lawmakers are capable of doing a big bill without Madigan. I think that's a boost of confidence for a lot of the leaders, especially Madigan's replacement, Chris Welch, and the new Senate president, new-ish, I should say, Don Harmon, and, you know, the governor. And it was not pretty. There's probably some scars left behind, but in the end, they did it.
Pivoting off of what Hannah was saying there, there are a couple political angles to this that are interesting to me. First of all, when you talk about the folks in Byron and the jobs there, what's really fascinating to me is that several of the Republican lawmakers who represent that area and represent folks who work at the plant voted against the law. You have Brian Stewart from Freeport, Dave Severson from Rockford, Andrew Chesney, who's also from Freeport, voting against a law that is going to help you know, preserve jobs for their constituents, preserve tax revenue for the school district in Byron and other local taxing bodies. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, that's very reliably Republican territory up there. But it's going to be interesting to see how voters think about that when they head to the polls next year, when every member of the General Assembly is up for election. If there are, you know, either primary challengers who are able to capitalize on that, or, you know, if that's an area, you know, it'd be surprising to see a Democrat win up there, but just if there are any repercussions that they suffer as a result of that. And the other thing is just, you know, this is yet another big sweeping bill that Pritzker has been able to sign into law as he heads into his reelection bid next year. You know, climate goals were part of his campaign in 2018. And it's another thing that he can point to that he can say, you know, I said I was going to get something done, and I did, you know, along with legalizing marijuana and other big, big high profile issues like that.
Well, going back to Exelon and Commonwealth Edison and people having to pay more in their bills, things of that nature, keeping these plants open, there had been this thought, I believe it was touched on there, about how with Madigan not there, that maybe they were going to lose some clout in the legislature. It seemed to me they got a lot of what they wanted. They came out a winner in this, didn't they, Dan?
They wanted subsidies for their sixth plant now, the LaSalle one, which is the only one not receiving some form of subsidy via state law. And, you know, some of the consumer advocates, the Illinois Public Interest Research Group in particular, has pointed to the fact that, you know, some of the rate structures that they had gotten in previous law are being eliminated, but there are other policies that are being maintained that are going to guarantee profits for ComEd and Exelon well into the future. So it's, you know, it's hard to see that their bargaining position was really weakened all that much. I mean, when you're able to, you know, sort of dangle thousands of high paying union jobs over folks' heads, it's a powerful bargaining chip, I think.
Yeah, Charlie, before we move on from this topic, I just wanted to give you kind of the last word on what you saw, how it all came together, and your thoughts about, you know, what it might mean going forward as far as just working relationships in the legislature and such.
Well, I think it showed that there's a new era in the House, because as we've mentioned before, back in the day, former House Speaker Michael Madigan would kind of orchestrate things. He really didn't delegate a lot of responsibility in these kinds of issues. He played it close to the vest. And the new speaker, Chris Welch, basically assigned other lawmakers, part of his leadership team, with different portions. One would work with the environmental groups. One would work with labor. One would work with the utility interests, people who one would work with the Black Caucus, people who had credibility because of their past record with those various interest groups, and therefore were able to be seen as honest brokers in trying to put together the final package. And I would have to agree that Exelon came out okay. I would guess the biggest setback they had is they came in and they asked for, I believe it was, they wanted $1 billion in subsidies to keep the nukes going. And they wound up having to settle for poor ComEd and poor Exelon, only $684 million.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and the Chicago Tribune's Dan Petrella. Well, I read the numbers every single day that come in our area, looking at COVID cases and what's going on there. Dan, you've been following a lot of this, including Southern Illinois this week. Some bad news there that they were actually ran out of ICU beds, at least for a period of time. What is going on in the state with COVID? Kind of where are we at this point, especially with this surge from the Delta variant? Or have we peaked? Are we, you know, is there still some a lot of concern out there that things are going to get worse? Where do things stand?
I think we're in kind of a tenuous moment. It seems, you know, cases and hospitalizations in general are starting to maybe flatten out or maybe even go down a little bit from where they were when they were kind of surging in July and then through August. But there are areas where the situation is very dire. You know, in Southern Illinois, they do this, all the regions do a census every day of available ICU beds. And for a few days now, there have been zero available ICU beds in Southern Illinois, staffed ICU beds. And even as they have added more beds, those have filled up. I noticed, you know, when we first reported on this earlier in the week, there were zero out of 88 staffed beds available. And then as of Wednesday evening, so the numbers that were released on Thursday, there were zero of 94 staffed ICU beds available. You know, and going back to the clip that you played at the top of the show, health officials in Southern Illinois aren't surprised by this because they have the lowest vaccination rates in the state. And, you know, it's been a struggle to get people statewide, but especially in that area to get the vaccine. And that's part of what is driving this Delta surge.
Yeah, Hannah, speaking of the vaccine, the governor's mandate for a lot of public employees to have to start getting this, and of course, college students and others, he pushed the date back to implement that vaccine mandate, but it's here now. Is that has to help the situation, I would think, as far as it's going to force people who don't want to get it, but they're either going to have to do it or undergo testing or maybe even quit their job in some cases. It's going to probably boost these numbers, right?
Well, I mean, we'll see. September 19th, which is Sunday, is the deadline to either, you know, get your first dose if you're a teacher, a university staff, or student, a healthcare professional, including private nursing home employees. You know, they're supposed to get their first vaccination by Sunday, or like you said, undergo at least weekly testing. We'll see if that helps. Obviously, we hope. But, you know, the thing about the numbers is that in most regions, except for Southern Illinois, The numbers have already, at least in terms of the positivity rate, peaked. Now, hospitalizations are kind of our most accurate data point because, you know, the number of cases and even positivity rate you can't necessarily rely on because the amount of testing has ramped back up in recent weeks. And so it's difficult to tell, especially when you're, you know, for example, in a setting where in a school where there's going to be a ton of testing just to test, because that's what you got to do. And so you're going to automatically drive down that positivity rate. But, you know, the other outstanding issue is that by October 4th, you know, the governor announced this, gosh, 2 months ago, sometime in early August, I believe, that AFSCME, or that state employees who are represented by AFSCME, who are frontline workers in, you know, say prisons, congregate care facilities like group homes, et cetera, they would have to be vaccinated and there's no, you know, testing option for them. And it doesn't seem like the governor's office and AFSCME have reached any sort of agreement yet on, you know, bargaining that. And I know anecdotally that AFSCME is recommending to their employees to not get vaccinated yet if they don't want to, and wait for the union to work it out. But I guess we'll see. It's a wait and see game. Obviously, Delta, we saw this summer, especially in the later part of July and August, how dangerous it could be. And especially, you know, it obviously more viral and also more virulent, meaning, you know, possibly deadlier, and also led to a rise in breakthrough cases, which is concerning. Obviously, you're still protected. Most people who have a breakthrough case are just fine. It's more like a cold and they don't need to be hospitalized, but there are certain percent, very small percent of cases that, breakthrough cases where you're going to end up in the hospital, and unfortunately an even smaller percent of those who will die.
Yeah, Charlie, AFSCME, going back to that, that is the union's in a tough spot there, I would guess, because the union's role is to represent its membership. And of course, the union also wants to keep everything sort of in a collective bargaining role. They don't want to agree to something or just say, yeah, we'll go along with it. They want to sit down and they want to bargain this type of thing. AFSCME's got a tough one here to try to work out. And so does the governor's office to try to work with them, don't they?
Yeah, I think it is tough. But I would argue that part of being in union leadership is also to educate your members. It's not to be, at least in my judgment, it's not to be just a rubber stamp for whatever the members want, particularly when it's on an issue like this that is vitally important to their health and the health of the people that they work with. I would fault AFSCME for not taking a stronger position and telling their members, come on, take the shot. As I say, I would tell AFSCME, be a leader in this.
Hannah, real quick before we run out of time and about a minute to go here, some court action this week that gave the anti-mask supporters something to, I guess, hang their hat on there. Explain what took place.
Yeah, there was a couple decisions in the Fourth Circuit, which is, you know, central part of Southern Illinois county courts. One of them, the judge there gave a 30-day temporary restraining order in favor of, you know, a group of parents who did not want to see their children masked. The argument was that children should not have to be forced to use a medical device, the medical device in question being a mask, in order to access their education. Of course, this will be appealed. Also, we saw the legislature, this 12-member body called the Joint Commission on Administrative Rules, brought the State Board of Education in front of them. I think it was Tuesday. If listeners remember, maybe a month ago, we were discussing how the governor had and ISBE had said, you know, if school districts are not going to follow our mask mandate in schools, then we will cut off funding for them, and for private schools, strip them of their recognition status. And JCAR unanimously, which is kind of remarkable, said, hey, ISBE, I don't think you have the authority to do that. You know, at the very least, you have to prove via, you know, emergency rules that you have the authority. You can't just say it. Really a victory for the, you know, doing things the right way, having a process in place.
Okay, time now for our notes from the field. And Dan, let's start with you.
Well, back to our earlier conversation on energy, I wanted to point out a story by my colleague Michael Hawthorne, who covers the environment for us at the Tribune, about one of the things the energy bill doesn't touch, which is coal that is mined here in Illinois and burned largely out of state, which contributed more carbon to the atmosphere in 2020 than all of the state's coal and natural gas plants combined. So just something to think about going forward as we look at the way Illinois contributes to climate change.
Hannah?
It's been a couple, 3 weeks now, almost, since the U.S. Supreme Court decided to keep their hands off of the Texas 6-week abortion ban, because the law says that citizens are able to, you know, kind of put out $10,000 bounties on folks who either seek abortions after 6 weeks or providers who would give abortions after 6 weeks. And so in kind of a troll of that law, Democratic House member Kelly Cassidy, who has been at the forefront of, you know, pushes for abortion access here in Illinois, she filed the so-called Texas Act this week, the Expanding Abortion Services Act, which initials is the acronym Texas, which would allow citizens of Illinois to put, you know, to seek $10,000 in damages at minimum for those who cause unwanted pregnancies or commit domestic violence, sexual assault, or abuse. So it's kind of a turning the Texas style law on its head.
And Charlie.
Well, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which is the basically the fiscal gurus for the legislature, came out with its latest edition of Wagering in Illinois. And it pointed out that the state's share of tax revenue from wagering of all sorts was roughly $1.4 billion, which was an 11% increase over FY20. FY20 numbers were down because of COVID. But reading through the report, I found it interesting. The lottery had $3.4 billion in sales, which is the most ever in the history of the lottery. The analyst attributed that to the fact that people really couldn't get out to do whatever kind of gambling they may want to do, and they could just buy lottery tickets online or at the grocery store when we were able to go back into the grocery store. And so the lottery was really up. Video gaming was up dramatically too. And one interesting side note, the commission report lists the top municipalities with video gaming. Springfield has more video gaming terminals than any other city or any other unincorporated portion of the county in the state of Illinois, and it's by a wide margin.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Dan Petrella with the Chicago Tribune. A reminder, you can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. And join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.